Welcome to the Musings on Sports podcast for Tuesday, August 30th, 2022. I'm Kelly Elvin, along with my co-host and good friend, Bob Bupka. Bob, you know, in sports, that final result always doesn't turn out the way we might expect it to be. And our guest later today, Tom McMillan, unfortunately learned that all too well firsthand as a member of the 1972 U.S. men's Olympic basketball team that, quote, lost to the Soviets, coming up on 50 years of that. Amazing. And we're just a couple days removed, quite honestly, from Scottie Scheffler finding out the hard way that even with a six-shot lead, Bob, heading into the final round of the Tour Championship, the result was not what he had expected.
Well, it certainly was not what he expected. I know one thing, the prayers of the PGA Tour were answered in many, many ways. Had Scottie Scheffler won, but won in a rout, the cries would be the format where they start the best players with a handicap advantage. The cries would have been loud and far-reaching. The PGA Tour dodged that bullet. Rory being the leading spokesperson, as you well know, Kelly, on behalf of the PGA Tour against LIV, is the best possible guy they could have win their tour championship. So it was a big weekend for Rory McIlroy, but I'll say this much. It was even a bigger weekend for the PGA Tour and Jay Monahan.
So let's talk about that for a minute. You mentioned about the staggered scoring from the start with, in this case, Scottie Scheffler starting out at 10 under par with a two-shot lead on Thursday morning. Do you like that format?
I hate that format. Here's the dilemma. You have to do something to reward somebody for outstanding play for a year. But taking the best player for the year and then giving him a couple of under par more than the nearest competitor, you know, it'd be like, to me, I think of Usain Bolt, world record holder, 100-yard dash. I tell you what we're going to do. Usain, you've been running so great on this next race, you only have to run 90 yards. And let's see if they can beat you. I mean, I don't know the answer. Nobody knows the answer. The intense search, Kelly, for that answer, you know, that fire was put out quite a bit by the absolute perfect results as far as the PGA Tour was concerned. I mean, they couldn't get a better winner than Rory McIlroy. He's an outstanding ambassador for the game. Some of his comments that he made after the victory, I can't say that I'm in love with, but hey, Rory's Rory, and I guess when you've done what he's done in the world of golf, everything is okay. I still go back to his mom and dad who sacrificed, worked 2 to 3 jobs when Rory was a youngster just so they would have enough money to send him to junior tournaments. They deserve a lot of credit.
And you talked about searching for answers. You were talking about the format, but it's been an ongoing search for answers for the PGA Tour throughout this summer of LIV Golf, Bob. They have completely changed the format going forward for their events. You have apparently a commitment by top players to play in upwards of 20 events. And you saw from the results, even though Scottie Scheffler didn't win the Tour Championship, he finished just shy of $25 million in on-course earnings and bonus money, which is an all-time single-season PGA Tour record. You know, for an organization that can't keep up with the Saudi money that's going into LIV Golf, the PGA Tour is certainly doing a lot to appease the top players, and I think that's the way they have to do it. Quite honestly, you have to keep your best players in the fold. I do get concerned being someone who's lived here in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida for coming up on 20 years for an event like the Honda Classic. Now, it may fall into one of these last four $20 million events that are part of the new structure for the PGA Tour. But boy, Bob, when you have an event here that's incredibly well attended, incredibly supported by Honda, the longest tenured sponsor on the PGA Tour, events like this that's held that it's always either the first or second Florida Swing event, you can't push those events to the side. They have to be among the cream of the crop, in my opinion.
Well, that's a good opinion, Kelly, but the dilemma is, you know, under the new deal, they get these big events with the $20 million purses. They're going to want to play in those. They're going to want to play in the Players' Championship. They're going to want to play in the majors. Now, that leaves great events, and I mean great. I've been associated with the Honda Classic for more than 20 years, and the job they do and the way they handle things down there, I mean, it is first class from start to finish. But somebody's going to have to pay the price. These players cannot play everywhere every week. I mean, that would be the ideal scenario, but that's not the case. But, you know, you have to step back. And I took a step back over the last past few weeks, I should say, and looking at the face of the PGA Tour. I was in position for quite a few years where had a radio show and had places like Foxwoods, the big casino in Connecticut, that wanted to be my sponsor. They have two golf courses built by Reese Jones. I mean, they're big in the golf. Tour said, we will have no reference to gambling on any PGA Tour event. Oh, well, now every other word out of the announcer's mouth are what the current odds are. We'll have, guaranteed appearance money, strictly taboo. Basically, when they create these big events, they're, masking appearance money. I mean, they're willing to make whatever changes they have to make now to be competitive with LIV. But, boy, it's just pretty amazing that the things they fought against for so many years suddenly are okay. Matter of fact, more than okay, they're looked upon with a blessing from the PGA Tour.
Yeah, and I guess you hear the word evolve, and I guess in this case, Bob, whether you like it or not, that's how things have evolved on the PGA Tour. And clearly, as you said, and again, when you start, when you see more players, top players, in the case of Cam Smith, for example, leaving to go play LIV, that's a big dent in the PGA Tour. Let's make no mistake, winner of the Players' Championship, winner of the Open Championship, second-ranked player in the world, you can't have a steady stream of that. You have to do things that, quote, evolve your tour in directions that, yeah, I'm sure that Dean Beeman and frankly, Tim Fincham never anticipated they would do, but that's where we are in 2022. And the decisions, it's also decisions, Bob, about the whole, to me, it's about the totality of all the players on the PGA Tour. You know, now you're going to be cutting the FedEx Cup playoffs next year to the low 70 as opposed to the low 125, which I like. I'm a big fan of better performance throughout the year than recognizing mediocrity. But your dynamic of trying to serve that entire membership on the PGA Tour changes. It's changed, I think, very much just with the announcement of these major events and the way they're structured now.
How about the upcoming dilemma for the PGA Tour when the Players' Championship is in a few weeks and Cam Smith is the defending champion, but he's going to be told he can't play because he's a member of LIV?
Yep.
Now, how's that going to look?
It's going to be talked about, and it will, that he won't play, and it will look awkward. My bigger question to you, to me right now, there are two, maybe three of the most powerful people in the game. I guess you could put Jay Monahan in there in a way because he has to be, because he's reactive. Greg Norman clearly is. Tiger Woods clearly is. Rory McIlroy certainly is. But Fred Ridley, in my opinion, cannot be discounted as one of the most powerful people in golf right now, because the decisions that he will make affecting the Masters tournament going forward will have major effects on the world of golf. If Fred Ridley, as the chairman of the Augusta National Golf Club, if he were to say, look, going forward, we've made a policy change to exempt status in the Masters tournament, and all those who will be invited must be members in good standing on the PGA Tour to be playing in our event going forward. Would Fred Ridley dare do that? Would Fred Ridley and the Masters keep the likes of Phil Mickelson and Sergio Garcia and past champions from the Masters, Dustin Johnson, out of the Masters because they didn't win, they're not members of the PGA Tour? Would that happen? Could that happen, Bob?
Well, it certainly could happen. And just to clarify one thing, as I understand it, to play in the Masters, I mean, if you're a member of the European Tour, the Asian Tour, besides the PGA Tour, you are eligible to participate. But you bring up a wonderful point. Is Fred Ridley going to weaken his field at Augusta? I don't know. In layman's terms, to take the side of Jay Monahan versus Liv Golf.
And that's the word. Yeah. I agree with you on that. That's the word. Would it be viewed as weakening the most prestigious event in golf? Would you be weakening the field, or would you be potentially opening it up to more aspiring players on the PGA Tour who you may strengthen the category of the exempt players coming in from the PGA Tour, from the FedEx Cup standings, 2 weeks out from the Masters? I don't know. It's as big a decision as any in golf, because the RNA didn't make any secrets to the fact that they want nothing to do with Liv. Hell, they didn't invite Greg Norman. They didn't invite Phil to be part of either that four-hole event on Monday or the Champions Dinner. So the RNA, the Royal and Ancient, is hardly a fan of Liv Golf. The decision that Fred will make will have tremendous ramifications, and however he reacts, it will be fascinating to see how the other governing bodies then fall in line or differ in any modifications they might make to their exempt status into their four majors. And again, those four major championships have never been more of the pinnacle of the game than they are right now.
I know if I'm Liv Golf and I'm Greg Norman and Fred Ridley, as you accurately point out, has that power. If he rules that they cannot participate and they can't be in attendance to that champions dinner, I'm Greg Norman. I'm going to invite all past champions of the Masters to a dinner that same night, and I'm going to pay you $10 million for showing up and eating my dinner instead of eating at the clubhouse at Augusta National, and then see what happens.
Yeah. Does Augusta National Golf Club operate separately and make its decisions based solely on how they see things, or are they in any, not using the term collusion at all, are they working because of a relationship with the PGA Tour? Are they in support of the PGA Tour in the decisions that they make? I think that's as big a deal as any when it comes to sports and when it comes to golf. Tom McMillan, we talked with Tom a couple weeks ago, Bob, in advance of this interview, and Tom was an All-American at the University of Maryland, basketball player, was a Rhodes Scholar, forfeited, I think, a couple years after he was drafted in the NBA, and then in 72, before he was drafted, was the Olympic Games, and Tom will kind of lay out what happened there in those final, rather really infamous 3 seconds when the ball was literally inbounded three times, and the final time the Soviets caught it and laid it in and won it. But Bob, you put Olympic moments up there like the 1980 hockey team winning in Lake Placid over the Soviets, and this one's right up there with just almost surreal Olympic moments in the history of the games.
Probably one of the greatest injustices ever in any sport. And hard to believe we're coming up on 50 years, and Tom McMillan has some wonderful insight to exactly what transpired during that very tumultuous basketball game.
Yeah, he really does. And also, Tom was a congressman from the state of Maryland, so an incredibly varied career. You'll hear from Tom McMillan about all of that in just a minute, right after this word from our friends at Bridgestone Golf.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B, with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover, the smarter tour ball.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. Bob, it is hard to believe that we are coming up on 50 years since the most controversial and many, many would say notorious ending to any basketball game ever. And our guest today was smack dab in the middle of it as a member of the United States men's basketball team that came up 1 point short. It's hard to say that they lost. They came up 1 point short to the Soviet Union in the gold medal game at the 1972 Summer Games in Munich, Germany. Here to talk about that infamous day, as well as his remarkable career, both on and off the court, is the pride of Mansfield, Pennsylvania, Tom McMillan. Congressman, welcome to Musings on Sports.
Well, it's great to be with you, and thank you for the invitation to talk about some very historic kind of matters. So I'm looking forward to doing this.
Hey, Tom, Bob Bupke here, and I echo the sentiments of Kelly. I certainly appreciate you taking the time out. Have a little skin in the game because, as I told you before we went on the air, good friends with Kevin Joyce, and he was your teammate for that game, and a game that I'll never forget, and I'm sure a lot of people would prefer to forget it, but we're going to find out more about it thanks to you taking the time to come on the air with us.
Well, it's one of those things that, you know, with time kind of passes, people do forget. There are fewer people alive when that game was played, and yet probably the most controversial Olympic game of all time, and particularly timely, given kind of we're back in the same old Cold War with Russia.
Yeah, Tom, I was going to say, you certainly had the backdrop of the Cold War in 72. Let's talk for a second. Help our, whether they saw it in person or are new to it. 3 seconds left in the game. Doug Collins had just hit 2 free throws to put the U.S. up by a point. From your perspective, being on the floor, what happened?
Well, what happened was the Soviets took the ball in, raced it up the court, and their assistant coach ran on the floor and stopped the play, which should have been a technical. And because they were complaining that they didn't get the timeout that they supposedly were asking for honored, but you know whether the on the court officials did not stop the game, so theoretically it was a live ball and the Soviets basically ran on the court and stopped the play, which itself should have been a technical foul. But then, you know, they decided to set it up again. This was the second time. And then they threw the ball in and went up the court. Time ran out. And that's kind of when we were jumping for joy because it was definitely seemed like we had won the game at that point. You know, what happened was this official of the FIBA, his name is Jones, came down from the stands. It would be like the commissioner of the NBA coming down and saying, no, we're going to reset the clock. Because what happened on the second play, the scores table screwed up the clock and didn't start the clock. And so they ended up replaying the play one more time. And on that time, they threw the ball the length of the pass. They even made a substitution, which they shouldn't have been able to do. And they threw the length of the ball at the court, and the Soviets scored. But it was a comedy of errors, and it, you know, we should have won it right at the beginning, and they just kept playing it over and over again. And it will go down in history, as it already has, as probably one of the most controversial Olympic matches of all time. But clearly, clearly there was so much geopolitics to it, because the Russians had not ever beaten the United States for the finals. I think it was about 7 or 8 Olympics.
And the United States had won all 7 of the previous Olympic Games, and your record coming into that final against the Soviets was 63-0.
Right. And this was the 50th game the Soviets were playing, and they wanted to they had won 49 gold medals, and they were trying to get to 50 because it was the 50th anniversary of the establishment of the Soviet Union. And so that's sort of another side to this. But it was just, kind of a sad moment in sports history.
You know, Tom, excuse me, there was a sidebar that took place in those games that also was very sad. Just a mere few days after a group of Palestinian terrorists stormed the Olympic Village and murdered 9 Israeli athletes, it just seems unthinkable that 2 events of that bizarre nature would take place in the same Olympics.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. I mean, you have to realize that the word terrorism was not a familiar term back then. People always call Munich the start of modern terrorism because, you didn't know what it was. You didn't understand. And all of a sudden, the village is full of policemen, and you could see the Arab terrorists on the balconies taking the Israeli terrorists. Taking them hostage. And here we are, we have to play a world championship game 5 days later. And it's hard to practice. You kept thinking about it. And, at the time I probably thought, well, maybe they should cancel the games. But I think that would have been a tragic mistake because you would have had terrorists after terrorists going after the games in the future if they could disrupt it once. And so I think the right decision was to go forward. But we played that game 5 days later. It was played at midnight because ABC wanted to have an audience back in the United States. So think about that. On the East Coast, that would have been about dinner time, but and they wanted to have a good audience in the United States, so that's why we ended up playing that game so late at night.
Tom McMillan joining us on Musings on Sports, remembering, not necessarily reminiscing, but remembering the championship gold medal game from the 72 Olympics. And Tom, I want to ask you some questions near and dear to my heart, being a University of Maryland fan, but one more on that Olympic Games. And that was, again, you guys, and for many, many years, the United States basketball team were a group of amateurs, and you clearly were playing against a group of professionals with the Soviets. I mean, you had Sergei Belov, Alexander Belov, I mean, guys who'd played for a long time together, some of them the teammates for 7 years. They were identified as soldiers and workers, but they were really professional basketball players. How did that feel going into that that Olympics and throughout that game that you were playing against professionals? Did you feel that you had something to prove? Did you feel like, oh my goodness, we're going up against a group of professionals? What was the mindset of the team?
No, we never really thought about it at the time. That's just the way it was. But, you know, when you look at it in perspective, you could realize that, you know, we were playing with, we were still dominating the world, even though we were playing our, you know, college kids, and they definitely were pros. The Soviet team was about 10 years older than us. That's why they've lost more players than we have due to longevity. But the interesting thing about it was, you know, when I was in Congress a few years later, the United States lost again, and I think it was 88, and I kind of circulated a petition that they ought to open it up to everybody. And, of course, they did in 92. The Dream Team came along. The other thing was quite ironic is that Dean Smith was the coach of the 76 team, and he asked me to play again on the Olympics. And because even though I was going to Oxford, I was playing in Italy for an Italian professional team, and I was getting paid, but I was considered an amateur. So it kind of pointed out the craziness of all this again, that I was asked to be on another Olympic team, even though I was drawing a pretty good salary as a basketball player in Italy.
You know, as I mentioned, for me personally, sitting alongside my dad, watched you play many a game at Cole Fieldhouse on the campus of the University of Maryland, along with Lenny Elmore, John Lucas, just fantastic teams under Lefty Driesell. Tell me, though, you were heavily recruited. How did it come about that you, being someone who Dean Smith very much wanted at North Carolina, that Coach Wooden at UCLA was very interested in having on his team, why Lefty, why Maryland?
Well, actually, you know, I pretty much eliminated the West Coast team, so I really wasn't that interested in UCLA. The schools I was interested in was Virginia, because of some family reasons. The coach was very close to my family. Maryland, obviously, because Jay, my brother, had played there. And North Carolina, which I very much admired Dean Smith. You know, indeed, Lefty came to Maryland, and you know, he was just a unique personality. But what really, the one thing that really changed my mind, because I initially committed to Dean and North Carolina, was that my father got ill my senior year, and I came back from an Olympic development tour in August, and he was pretty sick. And I know my dad wanted to see me play, and so, you know, I vowed then that I was going to go to the closer school, Maryland. It was a great school, and there were lots of reasons why I wanted to go to school there, because it's close to our nation's capital, and I had been appointed by President Nixon as the youngest presidential appointee ever set up to be a member of the President's Council on Physical Fitness. And so, you know, I chose to go to Maryland. Certainly, it worked out very well. And my father ended up passing away my senior year, saw so many of my games. But, you know, Coach Driesell, you know, you look back at it, I was able to go to Maryland and really help build something. Where if I'd gone to Carolina, I would have been perpetuating something. And so it made a difference to go to Maryland. I have the utmost respect for Carolina and Dean Smith. You know, there were other reasons. The fact that I was able to be in the nation's capital. I worked in the Senate one summer. I was on a presidential commission. And my dad got to see me play.
Great backstories. I wasn't aware about your dad. And speaking of that senior season, and again, unfortunately, this was a loss, but Maryland played what is still considered one of the greatest college basketball games ever, overtime loss in the 74 Atlantic Coast Conference championship game to David Thompson and NC State. And I believe that was that your last game as well, Tom? What do you remember from that? And again, that was at a time when you didn't have 64 teams going to the NCAA tournament. So literally winning that conference tournament was paramount, wasn't it?
Well, it was. In our sophomore year, we had won the NIT. Remember, back then, there were only 16 teams in the NIT which was a, you know, very, very much more illustrious tournament. And there were only 25 in the NCAA. You had to win your conference to go. So you think about the combination of them compared to 68 teams today, it was pretty special when we had won the NIT. So when we lost to State in that epic game, we decided that, you know, we kind of passed on the NIT again. We had sort of been there, done it, and we kind of retired from college sports. But that game was, what I remember is it was so well played. There were so many great players on the floor. And it could have gone either way. You know, obviously, Maryland was always hurt because we always had to play down in Tobacco Road. And North Carolina went on to win the national title. They played their ACC tournament in North Carolina, the Eastern Regionals in North Carolina, and the national final was in North Carolina. So it was. It turned out to be very fortuitous for North Carolina State because they ended up playing the ACC tournament in North Carolina and then the Eastern Regionals in North Carolina and the national finals in North Carolina. They beat UCLA. So it was kind of a Cinderella year for them, but it could have just as easily been us. I mean, we were so close and so competitive in State.
You know, Tom, speaking for our listeners, we're just delighted to have you on Musings on Sports. And, you know, you decided to postpone your NBA career after being drafted in the first round back in 1974 to attend the University of Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. Are you the only player ever drafted that said no to basketball and said yes to being a Rhodes Scholar?
Well, Bill Bradley had done that too. You know, he postponed. He postponed for 2 years. The Rhodes Scholarship is a 2-year scholarship. Now, he played a few games in Italy. What happened was that I went to Oxford, and I ended up playing a real schedule in Italy. I used to commute to Italy every week, twice a week. And I played 55 games in Italy sort of as a pro. And then I came back after 1 year to go into the ABA and the NBA draft. But I finished my Rhodes Scholarship over 3 summer terms. So I went back. So I only went 1 year full-time, and then I went 3 part-time years. So Bill Bradley was the only one who had done that before. I mean, I think it would be almost impossible to do today because the amount of money and how important these draft picks are, and not that they weren't important back then, but I don't think I could have gotten away with that today. And the owner of the Buffalo Braves who drafted me was from my hometown, so that helped a little bit as well. But it's one of those things that I don't think I could get away with today, or probably, for that matter, Bill Bradley would have had difficulty.
And no doubt about that. Well, 11 years in the NBA, you decide to pursue politics. Any stories that stand out from your NBA career? And what inspired you to run for the U.S. House of Representatives?
Well, I had studied politics at Oxford undergrad. I was an undergrad chemistry major. And so I was very interested in politics. I had worked in the Senate and I helped out in campaigns, helped with Bill Bradley's first campaign for the Senate. So when I was playing for the Atlanta Hawks, I had bought a house in Maryland. And after about 6 years in Atlanta, I went to Ted Turner, the owner of the team. I said, Ted, would you trade me to Washington because I want to run for Congress? And lo and behold, he traded me to Washington, and I played 3 years in Washington for the Bullets. And my last year, I announced for Congress before the season started and played a whole season as an announced candidate. I did that because, again, Bill Bradley told me to do it. He said, get your name out there, make some money. And I played, you know, all the way through May that year. My primary was in May. I won. And the election was in November, and I had a very close election. I won by 424 votes, but To this day, I think I'll be the only active NBA, active pro athlete who runs for Congress while they're still playing their sport.
And I think that you have to hold the record. When you do the research and it says that Tom McMillan is thought to be the tallest ever member of Congress. You being 6'11", I don't know that there are too many 7-footers, Tom, in the halls of Congress. And I'm wondering, having been among the trees, if you will, during your playing days, did that height, was there a height advantage at all, or at least people kind of looking up to you, at least in your early years in the House, of like, wow, this guy's really tall?
Well, I was the tallest, still the tallest member of Congress. We always had a joke in Maryland. Our senator, Barb Mikulski, they always said she was the shortest senator ever. She was 4'11". I'm not sure that was true, but certainly I was the tallest member of Congress. And Mikulski and I always kidded that we averaged out to a normal congressman. But when you're in politics, being tall is an advantage. People know that you're there, but they also know when you're not there. So I would be a little afraid today of standing out quite so much. The security risks of being a member of Congress are much higher today than they were when I was in Congress.
Indeed. Hey, I've got to ask you, you've stayed very close to your alma mater in College Park, serving on the University of Maryland's Board of Regents. The school made the decision to leave the ACC for the Big Ten starting in 2014. I'm wondering what that decision was like for you as a member of the Board of Regents, as a former player on the basketball team, to see your university forsake the conference that you had only known from the start.
Well, remember, my brother had played there too, so.
Oh, yeah, right.
What I didn't like was the process. We found out about it Friday, had to vote on it Monday. We got very little information. And you have to think about my recruiting situation. I went to Maryland because my dad could see me play. Well, what happens if Maryland had changed conferences? And, you know, Maryland played a lot of games. My dad could see me in Virginia. And we played a lot of local games. But now all of a sudden you're in the Big Ten. Maybe that wouldn't have been as easy. And so I think that part of the process is they oftentimes don't pay attention to any of the student athletes with respect to these decisions. I mean, and ultimately the decision was about money for Maryland. They got considerably more resources but they traded resources for tradition. And one of the things that's really, it's one of the trade-offs that's going on in college sports as we know it. And, the challenge for Maryland in the Big Ten is, can they ever be competitive football-wise? That's always that's going to be the burden they face. But hopefully they can, and hopefully the decision in the long run will be the right one.
Well, we're wrapping things up with Tom McMillan. We appreciate his time. You're the president and CEO of Lead One, which serves as the membership association of the 130 member universities that make up the NCAA Division I football subdivision. What is the mission of Lead One, and how are you keeping up with the rapidly changing college landscape?
Well, we're really kind of a policy shop. We work on issues around college sports. We look at alternatives, whether it's name, image, and likeness, or transfers, or academic eligibility, or you name it. We represent the 130 largest college athletic programs in the country that all have big-time football. And as I said, we work on all the kind of the biggest issues that you read about in college sports. And our 130 schools are pretty sizable. I think their revenues, just their athletic programs, are over $8 billion.
Tom, I have to ask you before we wrap things up, and Bob hinted at it there with the landscape changing as it is, Texas and Oklahoma soon to be in the SEC, and USC, UCLA, heading to the Big Ten. I mean, yeah, we talked about Maryland basically going cross country back in 14 to play for the big to play in the Big Ten and leave the East Coast. Are we going to see more of this? Do you see this as chaotic at all, or is this just the way it's going to continue to be with as much money as at stake in college athletics?
Well, I think it's because of the money, number one. You know, that's why I'm sure UCLA and USC moved to the Big Ten, because ultimately it's how you kind of put together the eyeballs for television. But the real issue is not so much football. I mean, football, they play a handful of games, and it doesn't take that much time away from school. And even basketball, they can do it because they can use charters and so forth. But it gets to all the other sports, and that's really where it becomes difficult for the softball team or the baseball team. And, you know, if you were just looking at football and said, okay, you want to have a national footprint, that would be one thing. But when you mix all the other sports, it gets very complicated. And it's tough on these kids. I mean, I was a pre-med student. I had chemistry labs. I oftentimes showed up for practice. If I was playing across the country, it would be pretty frequently. It'd be difficult. My senior year, I had a very tough December. My father died. I had two games on the West Coast, including UCLA and a Christmas tournament. I won the Rhodes Scholarship, and so I missed all my finals. But I knew that was extraordinary pressure, and I can't imagine if these kids have to do that frequently for a year. It can't be easy. So that's going to be one of the byproducts of all this. It's just going to be harder on these kids.
Let me throw this at you, Tom. I was good friends with Doug Sanders back in 1970. He had a 3-foot putt at St. Andrews to win the Open Championship, defeating Jack Nicklaus. He missed it, and then the next day lost in a playoff. I often asked him, hey, Doug, do you ever think about that putt you missed? And he would say, heck no, Bob. Sometimes 5 minutes goes by without me thinking about it. Do you ever allow yourself to think about that gold medal game?
Not really. You know, I think about it when people bring it up, but it's not one of those things that I really think about too much. I mean, of course, with the Ukrainian conflict with the Russians, I thought about the connectivity between the Cold War then and the Cold War now. So that's really about the extent of it.
Well, Tom McMillan, we thank you so very much for taking the time out and remembering about 72 and for everything you're doing right now through Lead One. It's I'm sure it's fun for you in a sense to be in the game still and to be making a difference in sports.
I'm enjoying it very much, and I've enjoyed being on your show today. Thank you.
Tom McMillan, thanks so much for joining us on Musings on Sports.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Bob, such a fascinating interview with Tom McMillan. He's done so many different things in his life. Extremely bright guy, was a tremendous player, and I know how proud he was of being part of that Olympics. But I know also, there's even though he says he doesn't think that much about those games, there's got to be some moments when he looks back and wishes he had that gold medal to be able to drape around his neck.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, when you think of what a wonderful achievement it is to get a Olympic gold medal and how horrific it has to be to have one basically stolen away from you.
Well, we thank Tom McMillan for joining us. Really excited about our guest for next week. The legendary broadcaster Dick Stockton will be joining us and we're just going to be a couple days out before the start of the 2022 NFL season. We'll talk to Dick about the NFL, but man, he's covered so much. The NBA, the Boston Red Sox, on and on and on. And we're looking forward to that conversation with Dick. I want to thank all of you for listening to Musings on Sports. You can find us on morningread.com and on all of the major platforms where you enjoy podcasts. For my good friend Bob Bupka, signing off. This is Kelly Elbin signing off. Thanks again for listening to Musings on Sports.